Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, and heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, as we do for the last show of every year, we're taking a look back at the stories that defined this year in Utah news. Stories of politics, religion, and activism, of tragedy, of hope, and of taxes. We won't be able to touch on every significant story, but we hope to do our best. And joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Good morning, and hello, and welcome, Matt.
Good morning.
Also joining us is Tribune Managing Editor Sheila McCann. Thanks for being here, Sheila.
Good morning.
And Managing Editor David Noyce. Hello, and welcome to you, David.
Hi, Roger.
Hello. Listeners, we invite you to join us with any questions or comments that you might have, and also a special request, your nominations for Underplayed Story of the Year. To do that, you can weigh in by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Managing Editor David Noyce, this week you compiled a Utah Year in Review for the Salt Lake Tribune. And before we dig into as many of those stories as we can squeeze into the hour, was there any one story that, I don't know, took the medal for the top Utah news item of 2019, or was it just too crowded of a field to be able to sort of crown one story as the story that that defined 2019?
Sort of yes and yes. There was a lot, and it's hard to pick one, but I think there was one, at least for Utahns, that emerged, and it had a presence nationally, internationally, and obviously here in Utah. And it was the impeachment of President Donald Trump. Mm. And of course, in Utah, a predominantly Mormon state, becoming less so, it was a very, very activist President Russell Nelson making a lot of changes, continuing what he had kind of done during his first year in office.
Okay, sort of a dual answer there. And maybe I should actually ask each of you that same question before we dig in further. Sheila, a defining story for 2019, or do you agree with Dave, or is there something different?
I think the defining story of 2019 is a national one. It's the Trump presidency and what's happening in our country this year. So I wouldn't pick one for Utah. I think the overall Utah story is how much Utah is changing and is continuing to change. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say one of those stories in our list was the news story of the year.
Canham?
One thing I'll point out is one that kind of culminated this year. For a couple years, we've looked at homelessness in our state. This is the year where those three new resource centers actually came online. It's still too early to say whether that is a success or a failure, but it reached a pinnacle that I think we've been waiting for a while.
Okay. A couple of picks for, again, the defining story of 2019. We are asking listeners for their picks for Underplayed Story of 2019. Again, you can call us at 801-355-TALK. David Noyce, I just want to read the beginning of your annual news wrap-up to set the stage here. You wrote, "It was a tale of two presidents for Utahns this year. One is challenging orthodoxy, stoking national divisions, piling up staggering deficits, and despite becoming the third such leader to be impeached, shows no signs of backing down. Another is changing a church, striving for global unity, sitting on eye-popping surpluses, and despite approaching centenarian status, shows no signs of letting up." And your opening paragraph goes on to lay out various other stories that held our attention this year, including reforms at the University of Utah after protests, scrutiny over the Utah Inland Port, the mayoral election, changes to homeless services, and stronger beer. But let's dig in with those two presidents that you mentioned. Obviously, U.S. President Donald Trump and LDS Church President Russell M. Nelson, as you pointed out. For President Trump, the latter part of the year had to do with impeachment, and you talked about that being a defining story of 2019. How was Utah connected to that story?
Well, Utah had a couple of key players, turns out, in the impeachment hearings and the process. First of all, you had Mitt Romney on the Senate side taking turns either poking at the president or placating the president. And then you had Chris Stewart, who was a member of the committee that heard evidence on the impeachment and became quite the stalwart defender of the president in those hearings, asked very few probing questions, was more there just defending the president and attacking the Democrats. Then you also had a Democrat, the first time we've had a Democrat in Congress for a couple of terms, in the Utah delegation, who faced a hard choice politically whether to vote to impeach the president, and that was Ben McAdams.
Hmm. And this is sort of the, there's this concept that in Utah we have Utah being unique for a Republican state when it comes to this story, and that has to do with just sort of people like Mitt Romney and others out there who, you know, as we look forward to the future and what might happen with impeachment after this, have a different take maybe on the president, on President Trump, than other Republicans. Can you talk about that aspect of this story?
As far as the Utah delegation?
Yeah, exactly. As far as the Utah delegation goes.
Yeah. Well, obviously you have, as I said, you have Rob Bishop, who's won in his last term, was fairly quiet during the impeachment process, but certainly was a defender of the president and gave no indication he was ever going to vote against the president on this issue, of course. One of the intriguing ones was John Curtis. He stayed on the sideline and stayed pretty quiet. Certainly didn't want made it clear he did not want to excuse the president's behavior, but did not feel like it rose to the level of impeachment. I don't know if that starts to answer your question.
It does. And then, yes, sure, Matt Cannon, weigh in on this. But I'm thinking a little bit about where this story actually is going from here, which is towards the Senate trial.
Right.
I mean, I think Utah's lawmakers have been very interesting in this because the state is not comfortable with the president. And because of that, we've elected people. Some of them are not comfortable with the president. John Curtis is an example. He did not vote for Donald Trump. And so him being a little more reticent to support the president is not surprising. Now it moves to the Senate. Trial supposedly will start in January. we'll see how this goes. You have Mike Lee, who is trying to coordinate with the White House on strategy when it comes to the trial. He is in White House meetings. He has talked with the White House lawyer. He is angling to be in the inner circle. And you have Mitt Romney, who's decidedly not. He is a person that the president has sparred with continuously, who has said he will be an objective juror when you have people like the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying he definitely will not be. And so I think Mitt Romney is in the position to be a wild card in this right now in this trial. But what that actually means, we'll see. The Washington Post tracks the comments of every senator. And the president has the votes to stay in office right now unless something significant changed. So what's really at stake here is how dramatic a trial will get. What the process will be, who will be witnesses. That's where Mitt Romney and a small group of Republicans could have influence. But can they actually help lead the president to be removed from office? That seems pretty far-fetched right now.
Pretty unlikely. Although the Washington Post also had a column by David Ignatius that called on Romney, saying that this is his moment.
Is,
yeah, Romney's moment in time to shine and make a difference or stand up in a way that goes against sort of party affiliation, party politics. There's a lot to get through in the show, and I want to get to it. But I also on the topic of Romney and what might happen in the Senate, Robert Gerke, in his tongue-in-cheek quiz over this year's news, referred to Romney's process of, quote, consternation, condemnation, capitulation, repeat. Just for all the talk of being willing to buck the party in the name of conscience, is that the reality of what Romney's actions have shown over this past year, senior managing editor?
That might be a pretty flippant way to put it. I mean, I do think that in this really partisan time, sometimes people will brush aside times when people aren't partisan as just being not that big a deal, when it actually is a significant step. Mitt Romney's criticism of the president was wholly unusual in the Senate, and he got barraged from the president for it. And that's a lot to take from one senator in the political atmosphere. So I do think there's a certain level of he's shown a willingness to step out. Does that mean he'll vote for removal? I have no idea.
We could get stuck here in politics and impeachment for the whole show if we're not careful. And before we move on, can we talk about how favorably or unfavorably, you know, you talked about the tale of two presidents, David Noyce, mm-hmm. how President Trump is viewed here in Utah in the wake of his impeachment late in the year here in the U.S. The year we're about to enter is, after all, an election year. Is there any recent polling on Trump's favorability in the state of Utah?
Yeah, the latest poll, although it was done early in December, I believe, showed that his numbers hadn't changed much. Matter of fact, they may have even increased a little bit. It's still a very divisive president. Republicans overwhelmingly support him. Democrats, not surprisingly, overwhelmingly don't. Independents in the state, much more divided. And that's kind of the way Utah politics generally is. Donald Trump's not real popular in Utah. He won the presidency with only 46% of the vote. So he didn't get a majority, which is amazingly low in a very, very red state. So personally, he's not really popular, but that R after his name still carries a lot of significance in this state, and I think the numbers sort of reflect that.
Sheila McCann, managing editor, do you have any thoughts on just that part of this, or we can move on to the rest of the year in review of news as well? Let's move on from politics. Okay, well, David, as we said, your article starts off talking about a tale of two presidents, and so let's turn to LDS Church President Russell M. Nelson. More recent news from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints involves its financial holdings, and we're going to get to that a little bit later on. But you wrote that in his nearly 2 years in office, the 95-year-old president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is overseeing an unprecedented period of rapid reforms, rescissions, adjustments, and announcements. What are some of those big changes that we've been seeing from this president, David?
The biggest this year, probably by far, both inside the church and certainly outside the church, was the reversal of the 2015 LGBTQ exclusion policy.
Right.
That policy has been very divisive and very controversial from the time it leaked out back in November 2015. The fact that it was reversed relatively quickly in LDS church eyes in just like three and a half years, whatever the timeline is, right, is fast.
Remind us what the policy was.
The policy essentially labeled same-sex couples in the LDS church as apostates. And probably the thing that was harder for members and others to swallow was the exclusion of their children being able to be baptized or have other religious rites in the faith. And they could only get that if they had specific approval from the top three leaders of the church. Mm. So it's generally an exclusion policy. That's how it got that name. And President Nelson rescinded it in April without much explanation. And it's interesting, too, that he was the one that rescinded it, since he's the one, just a few months after his implementation, said that it was a revelation from God in a speech in Hawaii. So the fact that it came from him rescinding it probably carried more weight, too. That was by far the biggest change.
Well, and he talked about revelation upon revelation upon revelation.
Exactly.
as a way for the church to change.
Didn't necessarily say that rescission was a revelation, but certainly implied that that's how this came to be.
Okay, and so this is why we're doing this explanation from the church.
They never gave an explanation, and perhaps a bigger deal to many is that it never came with any kind of an apology. It did, however, come with an acknowledgement that the church leaders realized this was causing a lot of pain in the church, and that if members felt pain, then they felt pain, is what he said.
Okay, and you wrote about this being maybe just the beginning in terms of changes to the way that the faith operates. There are other big changes that happened this past year, and then the suggestion that there are more changes coming. Can you talk about both the additional sort of big changes that Russell M. Nelson instituted within the church, and then also the idea that maybe more is waiting in the wings?
One quickly came at the first of the year, January 2nd, when we got word that from members that the LDS temple ceremonies had changed. Hmm. They have changed from time to time. Faithful members go to the temple to participate in the faith's highest ordinances, and the wording was changed into a much more gender-inclusive, much more female-friendly language. Many members, especially feminists in the church and outside, had complained about this language for years, and it was just quietly removed starting January 2nd. And that was a big change. Other changes on women's issues were allowing women to witness different ordinances. This is something that women had done early in the church but had been done away with, and now it's back. Scouts will be gone. Come January 1st.
Being replaced
the church's own program, which will be a worldwide program called Children and Youth. It's not exactly a name that sings. But anyway, that was another big change. Russell Nelson, in referring to the other part of your question, yeah. Russell Nelson said that there would be a lot of changes this year, meaning he said this in 2018, next year and the year after. Well, 2020 will be the year after. So we shall see what will be coming. But he certainly indicated that more changes of significance will come.
We talked about this just last week on the show, but big news from the end of 2019, the church getting criticism from both inside of the faith and from outside after a whistleblower said that the church's nonprofit investment arm had amassed $100 billion in this investment fund from contributions that were intended for but weren't spent on charity. And that's probably a story that will carry into 2020 as well.
Dave, I do believe it will. Yes.
Yeah. Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor, can you talk just about coverage of the church in general in Salt Lake City by the Salt Lake Tribune? Because you have this, a frequent criticism you see in letters to the editor of the Tribune is that you're covering the faith too much, or you're not covering the faith enough. And, it's an interesting line that you have to walk. Can you just sort of talk about the philosophy of covering the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints here?
They are 60% of the population. That should probably be a starting point. But also, the way Jennifer Napier Pierce, our editor, talks about it, is she says we're a company town. If you read the Los Angeles Times, there's a lot of coverage of Hollywood. If you read the Detroit Free Press, there's a lot of coverage of the auto industry. If you read the Washington Post, there's extensive coverage of Congress. And there's reasons for this. The church is headquartered here. It has huge implications on the people who live here, whether you're a member or not. And we cover that really aggressively in all aspects, whether that's religion, the actual faith tenets, whether that is politics, whether that is culture, how it impacts us in religion and sports and every other aspect of our lives. It has a bigger impact here than it will in other states. And because of that, we cover it.
Just before we move on, I want to, David Noyce, get back into that $100 billion story because, it's money that the church, according to this whistleblower, has amassed and is sitting on. What are we waiting for from that story? I mean, we're waiting to see whether or not the IRS responds or what's the next shoe to drop here?
Well, obviously, we'd all like to get a finer detail on that fund. I think we're waiting. First of all, many experts feel like the IRS will not really turn up anything. The IRS hasn't said whether they're going to investigate. That's what the whistleblower wants, is to investigate. Whether they will or not, I don't know. It remains to be seen. We may never know exactly what the fallout from that is. I think the bigger questions that are being asked both inside and outside of the church is, number one, should the church or any church have that kind of reserve that was donated for charity and is not being used for that, just being held essentially as a stash of cash that, or at least can be turned into cash for whatever purposes the church may want? That's a big question. And whether the church should be transparent about its finances, which it used to report in its general conferences up until about the late 1950s, early 1960s. They weren't fully fleshed out reports, but they did talk about actual numbers. And so those are the questions being asked, whether the church will be transparent about that. And there's a good chance that you'll see more transparency coming on that.
Okay. Reminder to listeners that we'd love your thoughts on the stories from this past year in Utah news that we are covering today. Join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. We're also asking for your choice for Underplayed Story of the Year. Again, the number to call, 801-355-TALK, or tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. If we're going to do 2019 any justice, we've got to move on to other stories. And Managing Editor Sheila McCann, one big story this year was actually the aftermath of a tragedy that occurred last year in the fall of 2018, the killing of University of Utah student Lauren McCluskey. The fallout had much to do with the U of U's response to that tragedy, and as a result of, I guess you could call them, concerns over that response, the McCluskey family actually launched a lawsuit this year. What does the lawsuit want, Sheila? What are they trying to get accomplished?
Well, to catch you up, Lauren McCluskey was killed in October of 2018. And in December of 2018, an independent group gave 30 recommendations and probably more to the University of Utah, critiquing how it had handled her reports, how it had handled reports from her friends and family, everything from the way she was spoken to. She gave a police report in the lobby one day, to just not understanding the dynamics of intimate partner violence. It was a sweeping report, and we've really started to see that have its impact in 2019, not in 2018. So the biggest impact of this case, I do think, is in 2019. Mm. So the University of Utah has done more hiring. There was a finding they didn't have enough police officers. There was a finding that the department was not working well, did not have a productive relationship with the victim advocates on campus. Hopefully that's being remedied with the hiring of their own victim advocate now.
Right.
The university has done things like improved lighting, consolidated night classes. So if you have a night class, you're around other people. Offered a more expanded ride service if you need a ride home at night. Improved building security. They have had some pushback from students that this wasn't really the issue that the students saw. What the issue the students saw was not understanding intimate partner violence, not treating students well when they report crimes, not taking the report seriously, not treating them in a way they felt was respectful. It really wasn't the stranger danger that would be addressed by rides. So there has been some pushback this fall with students wanting the university to be a little more on point with what they see as the concerns. And those are some of the concerns raised in the McCluskey's lawsuit, that the University of Utah, in their opinion, had many opportunities to step in and stop this. The university president, Ruth Watkins, last December at the time that report came out, said the report did not give us a reason to believe it could have been prevented. And Lauren McCluskey's parents strongly disagree with that, pointing to multiple reports, multiple opportunities. One clear one is Melvin Rowland had been on parole. Had they discovered that fact, they might have revoked that parole. He might have been behind bars. Perhaps the murder wouldn't have happened. So that case now will continue. The McCluskeys have filed. The university has responded, saying that under the law they didn't have a duty in this case. They haven't done anything wrong. All those claims should be dismissed. The McCluskeys then filed their most recent response, along with the hiring of Christine Durham and some other hires on their legal team. Christine Durham is the former Chief Justice of the Utah Supreme Court.
There is also, there was specific criticism of the way that the University of Utah Police Department handled this case. I mean, this is what you're referring to in terms of recognizing that there was a problem when Lauren McCluskey was filing these reports with the agency. There have been some changes. Have there been some changes, actually, or substantial changes at that agency?
There have. They have put in a zero tolerance policy, expecting a certain level of response from their officers in a case like this. And in fact, two of the officers who were described as problematic by the independent investigators have left the department. One fired over her response in a similar case. The other has left the department, but he was disciplined for what was felt to be an inadequate response in a subsequent case.
And a change in leadership as well at the University of Utah Police. Yeah.
The chief has retired. There are three candidates the university is considering right now for his job. And in the meantime, they have hired a new, we're calling them a safety czar, but it's a position that's new that deals with all kinds of safety on campus, not just overseeing the police department, but dealing with cybersecurity, dealing with lab safety. All the issues that had been kind of divided up by departments will be under one person. And he is from NYU. His name is Marlon Lynch, and he will start February 1.
Okay. And that's some changes coming in the new year. Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor. This story has been well, big news. It's been something that you've been following at the Salt Lake Tribune for, since October of 2018 when this tragedy occurred. Is the story winding down in any way?
I don't think so, because it matters so much to the students who are on that campus. I think we cover institutions that are powerful institutions, and in this case, our coverage is focused on the University of Utah and what it has and has not done. We'll also cover this lawsuit as well, as it focuses on the same issues. They're still in the middle of taking steps, and it's not clear that that there's that trust that has been rebuilt. That actually, it hasn't. We know it hasn't. And that's a longer process that the University of Utah has even acknowledged. So I think this will be a significant story in 2020 for us, and probably longer than that.
Okay. Again, that is Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. We are going to take a quick break in the show. And when we come back, we'll continue our look at the stories that shaped this eventful year. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham and Managing Editors Sheila McCann and David Noyce. Today, we are looking back at the news year that was 2019, and you were invited to join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweet to at KCPW. And again, we are also asking for your pick for underplayed story of the year, a story that you think maybe deserved more play or greater scrutiny. Again, call us, 801-355-8255. Let's turn now to the massive development called the Utah Inland Port that was a big part of the news cycle this year. It was the focus of protests, of a lawsuit, of political campaigns as well during the mayoral election, which we're going to turn to as well pretty soon if we have time. David Noyce, a managing editor with the Tribune, why is this project so contentious and how did we get to where we are on this story?
How we got to where we are is complicated, especially as it came out in the campaign. But the inland port in the kind of northwest quadrant of Salt Lake City is touted as the largest economic development undertaking the state's ever done. So it's a massive project, very ambitious. As with all massive and ambitious projects, there are impacts from that. That's what's spurring protests and consternation, or at least criticism and wariness about this project, which I think many city residents feel like it was a state takeover, and in many respects it was. So they're a little worried about their own sovereignty of covering the things in their own city.
Which is the focus of a lawsuit.
A lawsuit by the mayor, by the outgoing mayor, Jackie Poskupski, of course. We'll see how that plays out. But the protests started sort of kind of like interrupt meetings to the point that they could not continue a meeting. And then in July, one protest turned violent, clashes between police and protesters, and it lasted for several hours, shut down some traffic. It was close to here.
Yeah, I was there.
Exactly. So that sort of amped up the wattage on this a lot.
Right. And then there was a police review over that specific protest and how police handled it. I mean, there was a finding in that just this last week, actually.
The finding was that the police, it was an internal review by the police department that said they didn't find that the officers had exhibited any excessive force, that would have caused some kind of discipline. Their videos and other witnesses, of course, have some serious questions about that as to whether that's the case. About a dozen protesters have since been charged, of course, with various felonies, misdemeanors, rioting kind of charges mainly. A lot of people see that report as kind of a whitewash.
I mentioned the mayor's lawsuit over the Utah Inland Port and this massive project. Again, it's a distribution hub, a place where goods can clear customs inland as opposed to a port on the coast. We're still awaiting an outcome on the lawsuit, right? Do we have any idea when that might happen?
I'm not really sure where that's at. I think they're still in discovery process, but
Canham.
So
Matt Canham.
The mayor was hoping by the end of the year.
Guess
that's what she asked for. And I don't know if she had some reason to believe that was possible, but that courts don't tend to move that fast. But I do think it will happen relatively quickly in the sense that if this thing goes on and development happens, then there's no reason to actually sue. So I think we'll get an answer here in the next month or two.
Anybody want to make a prediction?
I have no idea on this one.
Not the role of news people.
It was one where the actual court hearing, the judges were interested. It felt like there was some novel arguments, and they were very impressed with the arguments on both sides. So
some of it hinging on a single line phrase in the state constitution,
right.
Over who has jurisdiction over certain
lines.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where does the story go from here? Is the dust settling on this controversial project, or is 2020 going to see more protests, more controversy over this?
They actually had a meeting where they finished the meeting, which was a big step for the Inland Port Board. They went months without being able to do that. They have a new executive director who seems to want to have more outreach with people who have concerns. He's already said that coal won't be shipped through Salt Lake City, which is a concession to, I think, some of these protesters and environmentalists who are very concerned that we would have trains, open-air trains, where coal dust would just be flying through the city. He's already taken that off the table. This is a project that seems to be something that the state is very interested in and the big business is interested in. So I think this is more about shaping what this looks like than actually stopping it at this point. This is private land. You can't really tell people they can't have a business out there when it's already zoned for industrial purposes. So but the wrangling, though, is going to be significant.
Sure. And there are other environmental concerns other than just the coal aspect of this.
Oh, there's tons. Yeah. This is in near wetlands, and there's bird refuges out there.
World-class flyway.
You have
exactly. Yeah.
Truck travel increasing, so that impacts everyone's air quality. There are so many ways this will change Salt Lake City and could change the environment for people who live particularly on the west side.
Again, we are trying to stay at a certain clip to get through all of this packed news year, and so we need to turn to other stories, but you can find all of the Tribune's coverage on the Utah Inland Port at sltrib.com. David Noyce, homelessness and how we address it as a city, as a county, and as a state. That was a big story from 2019 as well, and something that you wrote about in your wrap-up of 2019 news. And that's because of a new model for trying to tackle the problem here.
Yeah. Matt referenced this at the start of the show, of course, that this will be the year that we see if all this works. They ended up, people over this, ended up closing the Road Home, which was sort of the warehouse kind of shelter downtown in the Rio Grande area that becomes subject of so much controversy. They ended up closing it later than they had originally planned to. Three resource centers have opened, two in Salt Lake City, one in South Salt Lake. They're supposed to be more of an in-house. They're not seen just as shelters, although they certainly are shelters. People stay there. But they offer more services for homeless, the idea being is that all these intact services with unique populations at each center may help move people from homelessness into housing quicker. This will be the year we see if all this works. There's big questions about whether there's enough room, of course. The Road Home ultimately could take in more people than these three resource centers. We'll see if it works this year.
Was the fundamental idea that people would be more quickly moved into these resource centers and then out of homelessness, and so there would be more bed space?
That's the hope, I think, is that and that having all these providers there, mental health providers, job counseling, everything right there in-house will be ultimately more humanitarian and helpful.
Okay. I'm going to keep us moving because we only have so much time in this show. And, unsurprisingly, both of the items that we just talked about, the Utah Inland Port and homelessness, were front and center in the Salt Lake City mayor's race. That happened this year, in case you forgot. There were some interesting turns in that race, and it started with a pretty crowded field of candidates, David Noyce, but got whittled down.
Yeah, it did. I don't remember, it was like nine or something like that candidates.
A lot.
Yeah, and names. A lot of people that, frankly, were deserving of a shot at being mayor. For most of the primary season, build up to the primary, Jim DeBacchus, former state senator, was leading in all the polls. His numbers really never changed much that whole time. But Aaron Mendenhall ended up winning the primary, and Luz Escamilla kind of eked out past DeBacchus to get a spot in the general election. It was a historic general election, the first time that two female candidates were the finalists for mayor. Of course, they would be replacing a female mayor, also Jackie Biskupski, who had dropped out earlier in the primary season. So it was a hard-fought campaign. I noted in what I wrote because it might have been a model campaign for what I think the nation would like to see. More campaigns like this. Very, very issue-focused. Many, many debates about really significant, important issues. Shots were thrown, as they should be in a campaign, but civil and two very well-qualified candidates kind of duked it out, and Aaron Mendenhall won. Actually, in quite convincing fashion, I think, by a wider margin than many people thought it would be.
58% to 42%. Mm-hmm. You wrote that in a wider sense, the real victors may have been the voters who had the privilege of deciding between two qualified, capable, competent candidates who ran hard-fought but civilly conducted and issues-focused campaigns. But you also,
I call that analysis. Yeah, that's is what I do when I.
you also note in the article that no woman, however, holds statewide elected office in the state of Utah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so there's just too much news to get through. I want to actually squeeze in a comment on something that we covered earlier today, which was a comment from David Borsos, who wrote to comments at kcpw.org. He says that I was disappointed this morning to hear on your program that President Nelson, this is of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, didn't offer any explanation to the church's rescission of its baptismal policy. I think that many people asked for one, and so he clarified this in September. David writes that you don't have to believe those statements or agree with them, but to say that no explanation was offered is disingenuous at best and deceitful at worst. So
tough comment.
I know, tough comment. Can you talk about the idea that there was a clarification by the church?
I guess I'd have to know exactly what he's referring to as to where that clarification came. I really was talking about the time before the conference when he talked about that.
Okay. Well, we'll go back. He points to an article in the Tribune that is by Peggy Fletcher Stack.
In September.
Mm-hmm. Right. You got it.
Before conference.
All right, listeners, again, if you want to join in this conversation, you can call us 801-355-TALK. Tweet to us at KCPW. Sheila McCann, I want to move away from Salt Lake City and head down to Provo for our next big story from 2019. It has to do with Brigham Young University and some changes made to policy there in the wake of demonstrations by students at the school. Which came in the wake of some Salt Lake Tribune reporting, actually, changes to something that we've heard a lot about, not just this year, BYU's honor code. So what are the changes and how did they come about? Sheila, it's a giant question, I know.
It's a giant question. It's another one that has a history that stretches back. So in 2016, students on campus began a conversation about how students who reported sexual assaults were being treated under the honor code. They argued that they were being punished. The school felt that that wasn't what they were doing, that those were two separate processes. But in the end, the school made sweeping changes to how it was handling reports of campus sexual assault, including giving amnesty both to students who reported they had been assaulted and to witnesses that came forward with them, which meant if you were sexually assaulted and perhaps you had been drinking a beer that evening, you would have amnesty. You would not need to fear that you couldn't come forward, you couldn't access counseling, you couldn't access help from the school because you'd had that beer, because you would be thrown out of school. Mm. That was the fear that students had. We did document some cases where students were disciplined in that kind of situation. So that was sweeping change that was promised at the end of 2016, formally put in place in 2017. And then this spring, students again started a conversation that was more broadly aimed at how the honor code was enforced. They were not complaining about the honor code itself. They take pride in the honor code. They want to comply with the honor code. Their problem was how it's enforced. For example, students might get a phone call asking them to come in or a letter asking them to come in. And that was all the information they had. They didn't know what they were being accused of. They didn't know who was accusing them. There was language in housing contracts and on the website that encouraged students to report on other students. So there were concerns by students this created a really toxic environment for them. So they raised these concerns, starting with an Instagram account, which is interesting because we saw students at the University of Utah using an Instagram account also to rally. And then it led to a rally on campus with hundreds of students in April, which is unusual at Brigham Young University. And the school has made these changes. Mm. You now get a presumption of innocence. Before you come in, you know what you have been accused of, how you've been accused of breaking the honor code, who has accused you. Some basic due process rights that I think the students weren't seeing. And that change was made.
Wow. There's also the some criticism of the BYU Police Department from the story stretching back, as you said, several years, but about the idea that BYU Police was working too closely with the Honor Code Office at the university. And have we seen action on that in terms of changing policy between how those two entities interact at BYU?
I'm not sure we know the answer to that, and that's something that's still under litigation. We were able to document that an officer with the Brigham Young University Campus Police Department was accessing records through his power as an officer and sharing information with the Honor Code Office. We documented that. We have the records. We have asked for more records to see perhaps how widespread that practice was. And we're still in litigation about that. So I don't think we have the full answer to that question, even now, 3 years later.
And we, meaning the Salt Lake Tribune, is still...
We, meaning the Salt Lake Tribune.
Okay.
And the public, for whom we're fighting.
Okay. So again, big changes to the Honor Code itself and how it is enforced at Brigham Young University, and then waiting for some further information on what happened at Brigham Young University during that time period. Any idea of where the story might be headed? I mean, with these changes instituted... does that fundamentally change the way that students exist and interact and be students at BYU University, at Brigham Young University, that is?
I think there are still some concerns at BYU Idaho that perhaps these changes are not happening at the same pace or of the same scope. We haven't heard more from students complaining at BYU. That's something we should probably check back in 2020. But the students raised concerns and the school responded to them. So I think that was a productive thing for them in 2019.
Okay. We're so low on time, and we still have more stories to get through. I think we should take another break in the show, and then when we come back, we'll try and turn to beer and taxes and maybe some other stories as well. You're listening to an annual recap of the news here on Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be right back.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Sheila McCann, and David Noyce. It is our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, and today we've been recapping an eventful 2019. And before we wrap up that recap, I want to squeeze in a couple of more stories that don't necessarily belong together, David Noyce, beer and taxes. let's eat our vegetables first. Tax reform. It happened towards the end of the year, but it's not to everyone's liking. And it was kind of a hard-fought, contentious reform package. Can you talk about how it came about?
Very much was. The seeds of this were planted during the session, the regular session, when they tried to take on this, you know, big topic of tax reform. And they realized they weren't going to be able to get that done. So they went on, and they wanted more public feedback. So they went on this really extended listening tour around the state, panel of lawmakers and others, hearing ideas from people. It was at least pitched as a listening tour. A lot of people thought more of a lobbying tour of just trying to convince the public that this needed to happen. A special session finally was held earlier this month, and tax reform did pass. It was talked about as a tax cut, and an overall tax cut. According to the state's numbers, it amounts to about $160 million tax cut. The problem is there are so many tax hikes also in the tax reform package that I think the public and many people are thinking, is this really a tax cut that's coming? The biggest thing is the food tax.
The grocery, yeah.
Being implemented again and amped up. And then also sales taxes, new sales taxes on various services. As the economy continues to shift, they feel like they need to do this. And by lowering what they were doing on income tax, it takes away guaranteed money from education.
Yeah, and that, right, so that takes away, because it's earmarked under the state constitution and is still, for the time being, earmarked under
and
the state constitution.
And it is, but the fact that they lowered the rate means there'll be less of that.
Matt Canham, any comments on this before we move on to beer?
Get ready for a bunch more talk on taxes throughout all of 2020. It'll be at the legislature and it could be on the ballot, so we'll see what happens.
Okay, and then just because we're low on time, David Noyce, let's move on to... The beer story is kind of a simple one. You can get somewhat stronger beer in Utah grocery stores now, and you'll likely not find Utah's once signature 3.2% beer by weight in grocery stores for much longer. No, you won't find it at all.
I'd be surprised if you find any. I think it's all gone out of the stores now.
Why did that happen?
Because the legislature finally, after 86 years, said it could. Since the end of Prohibition, that 4% alcohol by volume, or 3.2 by weight, as you said, was all that was allowed in convenience and grocery stores. The legislature, as more and more states fell away from that, manufacturers saying, we're just not going to make that anymore. We just don't have a big enough market. So the legislature finally, after years of trying, signed off and allowed that the stronger beer to be sold in grocery and convenience stores.
And that was kind of driven by again, as you said, the industry moving
market
away from—
forces really is, I think, what drove it.
From even— how did consumers respond to this?
One of the people we talked to said, hallelujah, it's about time. That was one of the first shoppers in a store in Bountiful. And I think that was pretty much the standard reply from everybody, sort of once again of it was another kind of odd, quirky Utah law that went away. But the reputation is probably still there, and there's still all some other oddities there.
Matt Canham, a bunch of beer was dumped down the drain because by law it had to be disposed of at some point from the Utah liquor stores. I don't know.
That's one of the—
Do we lose our quirkiness? Does the state of Utah lose its quirkiness as a result of
it? I think we got a ways to go to lose the quirkiness, but I do think that this, as Robert Gerke pointed out, gives tourists 25% less to complain about because the beer is 25% stronger.
I like it. Okay, well, David Noyce, you know, your story goes on and on. There's a lot of—
Tell me about it.
I mean, you've got the 35-day government shutdown. You've got John Huntsman Jr. leaving his job in hopes of winning back his old one, and so on and so forth.
The Tribune becoming a nonprofit.
But, yeah, that's—
In there, too. Yeah.
That is in there. But I think that in the interest of time, we need to just leave 2019 behind and turn to our underplayed stories of the year. Actually, first, you know, do you want to talk about stories that you think might make— it's hard to know what the news is going to be, but what 2020 might be defined by? Is there any signs in the tea leaves that you can read right now and say, this is what 2020 is going to be about?
One's obvious. It's on the calendar. It's Election Day.
Right.
It's going to be huge.
It's going to be really big nationally, of course, but in the state.
Yeah. Okay, that's an obvious one. Let's turn now to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the year this week. And actually, before I ask you all for your responses to that, I'm going to read a couple of listener replies. One from a listener on Twitter, TRP Hunter, says the least covered story is the destruction of the Pinyon Juniper Forest in southern Utah. That's his pick for, or his or her pick for, underplayed story of the year. Okay. Another listener, 88 Yang Gang Rising, writes at KCPW, most underplayed presidential candidate is Andrew Yang. So you've got those. Go. And then my mom weighed in, Ronnie McDonough.
You better read that one.
Yeah, exactly. And she said that the underplayed story of the year is the death of millions of bird species. And that's something that was reported by American Bird Conservancy and others. So with that, let's now turn to each of your picks for underplayed story of the year. And Sheila McCann, maybe we'll start with you.
Okay, my answer comes from my history as a court nerd, court reporter. I think one of our undercovered stories is, what is the legal standard, what is the legal expectation on our nation's universities in regard to student safety, somewhat in connection with sexual assault, but with broader issues as well. We have seen lawsuits filed against USU over a student who was sexually assaulting a string of women there, and the university was getting information over that time period. We've seen other suits against USU, and now the University of Utah is making this argument that the schools don't have a duty. They make an argument again about that in connection with Title IX. They also make an argument about that in connection with constitutional law and immunity that they can qualify for. And this is an area of law that I think is getting more discussion nationally, perhaps in connection with some police brutality allegations. But this is something that really raised a lot of concern with University of Utah students when they saw the university's brief that said, we don't have a legal duty here. That caused a lot of concern. The University of Utah said, holistically, of course we feel a responsibility. That was a legal argument. But the law is unsettled and challenging. It will be interesting to see if this case goes forward and gives us any clarity on that, the accountability of American universities, or will it settle and it'll just be left again for another day?
It is something that will obviously play into the next year, and a really great pick for Underplayed Story of the Year from Sheila McCann. Matt Canham, your choice for Underplayed Story of the Year.
I'll do a demographic one. We hit a milestone where our fertility rate is below replacement level. It means that the average family is having fewer children, not enough to actually replace their own population. That's a pretty startling fact for a state that is long known for having the largest family size. And I think that it will rapidly change this state, from how many children in our school systems to all kinds of cultural changes. And I think this is something that has been years in the making, but will continue to rapidly transform Utah.
Wow. Demographic changes from Matt Canham for his pick for Underplayed Story of the Year in 2019. And David Noyce, your choice.
Well, I'm going to riff off one of your listeners stole junipers dying, and that's climate change. I think it's, in many respects, it's the mother of all issues. And it's virtually underplayed every single year by us and everyone. The junipers are drought-resistant to drought-tolerant trees suddenly dying. And we've done a couple stories on this. Down in southern Utah, they're still trying to find the reasons why. It probably has to do with infestation. However, it's probably linked to climate change, as it was with the bark beetles that have wiped out big chunks of Dixie National Forest in the west. The fires, we had a relatively, by our standards, mild wildfire season, but certainly can't say that about California. So I see climate change is underplayed story of the year.
It's a, excuse me, a good pick for Underplayed Story of the Year. It was my pick as well. And so, David Noyce, we will just leave it there. And I will say, David Noyce, Matt Canham, and Sheila McCann, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for joining me for this recap of this wild news year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Behind the Headlines is a production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Operations Director Jesse Ellis for his work on the show today and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local shows at kcpw.org. Thanks for listening and Happy New Year, everybody.